Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Willow Verkirk. I'm a lecturer here at Kingston University, and I'm very pleased to be introducing you to the next two speakers, who are Mitch Abrador and Doug Green. Our first speaker today is going to be Mitch Abrador. His paper is called From the Siege to the Commune, Blanqui and Republican Defense. He's a translator living in Brooklyn. Among his books are Jean Jaurès's Socialist History of the French Revolution,
Voices of the Paris Commune.
I can't read his writing very well, sorry. And the Victor Serge anthology, Anarchists Never Surrender. He is currently preparing an oral history of the May 68 France.
Well, the events of May 68 in
France to be published in 2018 for the 50th anniversary of the event. Thank you.
And Eric is one of the people who I interviewed for the book. So before I start, I just want to say that 2 years ago, Doug and I sat on a panel about Blanqui, so there's a chance for us to continue a disagreement we had 2 years ago in New York. We just moved it across the Atlantic. And a year ago, Ian and I had a discussion about Jean Jaurès, and my great skill in life is the ability to work Jean Jaurès into almost anything. So I've managed to work him into Blanqui. So we'll be able to continue our disagreement of last year. And of course, there's going to be some overlap. Some of the stuff that Eric mentioned, I'll be talking about. So we'll see how that works out. So in any event, so 1870, when the events leading up to the commune began, Blanqui was living in exile in Brussels, but he was able to sneak pretty readily across the border. He had a sister who lived in Paris. He lived with her. And later on, there was a flat that was rented by his supporters so he could hide out whenever he wanted to. So he was there in France in early 1870 when the first big event that was to ultimately lead to the downfall of Napoleon III occurred, the killing of the journalist Victor Noir by one of the emperor's cousins, Prince Pierre, Napoleon Bonaparte. When Victor Noir, now we were talking, Eric was talking about Blanqui's grave. Everybody should note this down, look up Victor Noir's grave at Père Lachaise Cemetery. There's something very significant about Victor Noir's grave, about this, the figure of him that's laying on the tomb. It's quite notorious. Part of his body is rubbed for good luck. I'll just leave it at that. Okay, so in it, so when the cemetery, Victor Noir's funeral was caused for a huge demonstration. 200,000 people attended, and among them was Blanqui. And we know he was there because the great Jules Vallès, in his third volume of his autobiographical trilogy, wrote, "I see a little old man walking all by himself, but followed by the eyes of a group of men, among which I've recognized Blanqui's friends. It is he himself, the man who walks in the shadow of that wall, the man who has prowled all day along the edge of the volcano, watching to see whether above the crowd a flame will not break out, which would be the first flaming of the red flag. This solitary figure, this little old man, is Blanqui." After the Victor Noir's funeral, there's strikes, there's all kinds of activity, and then comes what's going to be the final event in the career of Napoleon III of the Second Empire, and that's the Franco-Prussian War. Won't go into all the ins and outs of it because we don't have years to discuss it. There were demonstrations all around France on August 9th when Thiers was named to the cabinet. And on August 11th, Blanqui crossed into France the next day and met with all of his followers. And the followers were pushing for some kind of activity. Most of the accounts say that Blanqui was pretty skeptical about what happened on August 14th, the event that Eric spoke about. Nevertheless, he went along with it. About 100 followers of Blanqui were involved. They attacked the fire barracks in Viette. And as Eric said, nobody followed them. So they retreated from the barracks and they marched down the boulevards crying, "Vive la République, aux armes, mort aux Prussiens," but no one joined them. It was pretty much over. The Blanquis dispersed. Two of them were arrested. A couple were sentenced to death, although the sentences were ultimately commuted. Then comes the big defeat on September 2nd, 1870, at the Battle of Sedan, and it was Blanqui and his followers who played a major role in establishing the Government of National Defense and in establishing the Republic. They were the first ones to put it forth. And as the great biographer Maurice Domanger, about whom Ian will be talking later, said of Blanqui on the day that the Republic was proclaimed, September 4th, 1870, "The patriot in Blanqui dominated the partisan. He suppressed his resentments, his forebodings, and in order not to divide the nation, rallied to the government, bringing it with him the support of his party." So it's a pretty positive, you know, Blanqui is suppressing all of his revolutionaries' beliefs. As has been said several times here, when there's a republic, he's behind the republic. But just to show how really poisoned the atmosphere in France was, in the first trial of the Communards after the events, the prosecutor said about the Blanqui and the Blanquis, "The presence of the enemy beneath the walls of Paris, far from discouraging their efforts, served as new fodder for their anarchistic efforts. Not satisfied with demanding the Commune and the Sortie en masse daily in their newspapers and their clubs, not satisfied with shouting about treason at the least failure of our troops, they didn't feel launching the armed masses on the Hotel de Ville on October 31st and January 22nd. So as if there's like two realities that are being lived through. You know, the Blanquists feel they're being like the real Republicans after the fall of the Commune. Didn't matter what they did, they were still nothing but a bunch of anarchist troublemakers. So what it makes clear is that the Republic that Blanqui supported so loudly and so consistently really had nothing to do with the one that would ultimately be run by Thiers. So the way to get around this was, and this is what Blanqui would often do during this period, was to deny that they were even Republicans, and that the only true Republicans were the revolutionaries who were gathered around him. Now, you know, until the Commune, this was a decidedly minority opinion. Domanger wrote that Blanqui would demonstrate on October 31st, which was another uprising, that it was only by entering into action against the Government of National Defection would the Blanquists remain faithful to the memory of 1792, an epoch when an enraged France attacked the Prussians within and the Prussians without at the same time. So now we're up to October 31st, 1870. And it's really one of the most confused days, I have to say, in this whole period. In the early morning, the people of Paris had learned that the mess had been surrendered, that it had been a sortie at Le Bourget, that had been a failure, and that the government had granted Thiers the power to negotiate an armistice with the Prussians. And so, in the scene worthy of the greatest journée of the French Revolution, crowds gathered condemning Trochu, the military governor of Paris, and calling for the Commune already. In the afternoon, the crowd gathered at the Hotel de Ville, where they were addressed by members of the Central Committee of the National Guard, and a variety of revolutionary orators, and where the mayors of all of Paris's arrondissement and the government were deliberating. Crowd invades the room, and in the room where people were deliberating, and before long, the government was held prisoner, and a new government was just proclaimed right there. And among those who were in the government were Victor Hugo, Henri Rochefort, Louis Blanc, and Blanqui. Now, Blanqui wasn't there at the time. He shows up later in the day, but it's a scene of utter confusion. And when he shows up to go into what he thinks is going to be his office, he's beaten up by troops who were there. God knows how anybody knew who was on what side when all this was going on. And he would write in his newspaper that he was horribly mistreated and thrown half-conscious into the corridor. He then sat down at his desk like a good bureaucrat, and as Lissagaré, in his great history of the French Revolution, wrote, Blanqui signed and signed again. And Blanqui would himself say that he only signed 7 decrees during this brief period where he was in the government, and the most important one being an appeal to the commanders of the front forts around Paris to keep an eye out for any attacks by the Prussians. But then opposition forces came in, they're all thrown out, and by the next morning, the army of reaction led by Trochu and the mobile guards from Brittany had rid the Hotel de Ville of the crowd. So Blanqui, it was discussed before about how important Paris was, and I'll be talking about it also, but Blanqui at the time wrote that the Parisians were vanquished not by the enemy, they succumbed from horror of civil war. They perished from the scruple their odious enemies never knew, that of spilling the blood of their fellow citizens. So already he's talking about how the workers of Paris, if they surrendered, it was only because they didn't want to inflict the bloodshed on Paris that would follow, of course, the crushing of the Commune. Now, one of the things that I mentioned before and has come up is how much support did any of the revolutionaries have at any of this time? So, after in October, the provisional government held a plebiscite to see, and it was Lissagaray said that the what was put before the voters was put in true imperial style. It was those who wish to maintain the government will vote aye. And in the vote went 321,373 for maintaining the government and 53,000 against. Municipal elections were held, and again, the revolutionary forces did not do very well in these elections at all. So, and about those who voted aye in the plebiscite, Blanqui said, they sold out the fatherland for a few pounds of meat, and what is more, the suicide has been accomplished. Paris is no more. There was one more revolutionary outburst before the Commune, and that took place on January 22nd, 1871, when a deputation largely made up of Blanquists attacked Mazas prison to free the Blanquists who were arrested there after the events of October 31st, and they then went to the Hotel de Ville. Now, again, Blanqui wasn't there for this. He sat in a cafe across the street. This is what it's in all the accounts, including Domanger. So he watched what was going on from the cafe. The crowd fills the Place de Grève in front of the Hotel de Ville. Shots were exchanged, people were killed, and 20 members of the crowd who were attacking the Hotel de Ville were killed. 6 days later, Paris capitulated, and Blanqui wrote to his friend Arthur Ranc calling for continued resistance, but it was all over. Now, elections were then held, and this is a sign, you know, one of the questions is, how popular really was Blanqui? And it's hard to say whether elections could give us an answer to the question, but they can at least give us an indication of how he was thought of. So elections were held in February, and Blanqui received 53,000 votes, about a quarter of the number of votes that were received by Louis Blanc, and 16,000 behind. There was a list of 43 people who were going to be elected. He fell 16,000 votes short of being number 43. So whether you can count elections as a measure of popularity and success, you know, can't say for sure, but it does give an indication of at least something. And one of his biographers wrote that when the Prussians entered Paris in March, it was the final humiliation of the patriotic Jacobin tradition was too much for the old man, and he fell ill, worn out by the long and heartbreaking siege and by the defeat of the French armies. And on March 11, even though there had been promises, there'd be no retaliations for anything that happened on October 31st, Blanqui was tried in absentia and sentenced to death. And on March 17th, the day before the events happened that begin the Commune, he was arrested. And he was held incommunicado the whole time and knew absolutely nothing of anything that was going on during the Commune, which was the event his whole life was leading up to. But actually, listening to the discussion before, something struck me. And it's got to do with organization and all of everything. Eric correctly said how everything that Blanqui did failed. Every uprising he did fail. And if you think about it, the Paris Commune happened out of nothing. There were no preparations. What happened was, on March 18th, two generals went up to Montmartre to recover cannons that the workers had paid for. The workers refused to give them up, and they killed the two generals. So for all of the Blanqui's lifetime of planning an uprising, the revolution being a week from Thursday, when the real revolution, I mean, the second great revolution in French history occurs, there was no planning. There was no secret conspiracy. There was no party. There was no group that prepared it. It was the people, their patriotism offended, their working class pride offended, their pride as Parisians offended, made the revolution without anybody pushing them to it. So for those who are fans of mass spontaneism, you can't get a better example in the Paris Commune, that for all the shying and the carrying on of people who organized parties, it was no party that made the revolution. Party. I really sounded Brooklyn there, didn't I? So Blanqui was held in prison, and the Commune would offer to exchange all of their hostages just for Blanqui. They held over 50 hostages, including the Archbishop of Paris. And the Versailles authorities refused to turn Blanqui over for fear that they would be turning over a rallying figure to the Commune, which without Blanqui had no central figure. That if I were to ask, you know, anybody, you know, even people who were experts in the area, the Commune was also the great revolution that had no leader. And that's why Michel Onfray, might offend some of the people here, sorry to mention Michel Onfray, but he talks about the tradition of the Communard left, a left that has no leaders and that's really motivated and pushed along by the people. Had Blanqui been there, it would have completely changed that, because he might have well have been that central figure that everybody would have looked up to, and then we would have been, whether the Commune would have won or not, it would have been on the road to being that another revolution where everybody follows behind a leader. It was going to lose anyway. There's no way the Commune was winning. But without Blanqui, it was this really great democratic celebration. Not that I think Blanqui should have been kept in jail, because when he was never exchanged, the hostages in the last week or so of the Commune were executed, and it's the black mark on the memory of the Commune is the executions that took place, carried out in large part by Blanquists, in fact, were behind the executions of the Commune's hostages. You know, the discussion that Doug and I had a couple years ago was, and I'm not going to waste much time on it, was would Blanqui's presence have made any difference? And Domanger, in his biography, talks about how with Blanqui, they would have had like a more dynamic military strategy. And they might have done the sortie, and they might have like gone out to fight the Versailles. Who knows? Maybe they would have. But what everybody forgets when talking about the Commune is, even had they broken through Versailles, the Prussians would have crushed them dead. And in the, not to plug my book, but I am, in my book, Voices of the Paris Commune, there's the bulk of the book is, in 1891, a great French magazine interviewed survivors of the Commune and asked them the same series of questions. Many of them had to do with, could the Commune have won? And almost, I think it was one of them who said the Commune ever could have won. So with Blanqui, without, you know, it probably wouldn't have made any difference. Now within the Commune, which goes to John's question over here, John, as I said, the Commune, the Blanquists were an important faction, not a huge one. You know, there was all kinds of partial elections, so between 7 and 11 members. And given that the Commune was primarily, you know, a patriotic uprising in the spirit of the French Revolution, it was where the Blanquists, you know, it was the only place for the Blanquists to be. And they occupied posts in the military and in the prosecutor's office. And this is where they were able to, that some of the deeds, again, that they're not, aren't thought very highly of, were carried out by the Blanquists. They were neo-Jacobins, well, they were them and the neo-Jacobins. They were all in the spirit of the Jacobins. They were enemies of the revolution, you know, pretty much got what they deserved. So they were spent their time ferreting out enemies. Now, among them, the Blanquists, was Théophile Ferré, who was a delegate for the police. and he was arrested after the fall of the commune, tried by a military court, and refused to recognize the court's jurisdiction. It was kind of a Jacques Vergès defense, even well before. I have nothing to answer to a bourgeois court for, to the enemy court. And he was the actual only member of the commune who died in front of a firing squad. There were others who were killed on the barricades or wherever. He was the only one to die before a firing squad. But there were delegates for war. Brunel, Eudes, and Duval were all Blanquists. And as we discussed before, when the commune divided into minority and majority, the Blanquists were a strong presence in the majority for setting up a committee of public safety, which was violently opposed by the minority, which was mostly members of the International. And people like Jules Vallès were just horrified at the idea that there would be a committee of public safety, which would be spell the end for the democracy that he loved so much in the commune. But it also, as Eric said, it never had a chance to do anything. So Blanqui wasn't there, but his followers were there. And Clément Roussel, who was a delegate for war, spoke of the Blanquists and Blanqui in his memoir. "I didn't have the honor of knowing Blanqui, who I consider a capable and energetic man. But either from a peculiar tendency of his personality or the needs of the times, he surrounded himself only with men of no worth, unworthy servants of liberty, narrow-minded and selfish men." Sorry, Doug. "Had Blanqui been there, he would have used his henchmen intelligently. He would have extracted the juice and tossed them aside after. But the master not being present, they thought they could replace him." And actually, even Gustave Le Français had this to say about the Blanquists. "The majority was unfortunately deprived of the only man who could have given it an intelligent leadership, and who, thanks to his influence over the majority of its members, could have rectified what was anarchic and childishly violent in their decisions." Now, whatever a lack of success Blanqui had in bourgeois elections, he didn't do badly in the elections to the commune. And he was actually elected to the sit by two arrondissements, and he chose to sit, he didn't choose to sit, he finally sat in absentia for the 20th arrondissement. Now, so through all this, there are underlying ideas that are really essential to understanding not just Blanqui, but as I was working on this paper, I realized that understanding a very important strain in French radical thought and activity. Marx wrote that when in September of 1870, right after the Declaration of the Republic, "the French working men must perform their duties as citizens, but at the same time, they must not allow themselves to be swayed by national memories of 1792. They have not to recapitulate the past, but to build up the future." This, though, is not something that would appeal to somebody like Blanqui. And as one of his biographers wrote, "Jacobinism triumphed over the primitive communism of Babeuf. With enthusiasm, Blanqui, along with the other Republicans, rallied to the defense of Paris. Momentarily forgetting his socialism, he returned to the most chauvinistic ideas, to a hatred of the Prussians and everything Germanic." And I'll give you some quotes later on that'll make everybody who's got hair have it stand on end. Now, Lenin also, I don't think you'll be having this one, also spoke of the danger of attachment to the French Revolution, which I think is a black mark on Lenin and demonstrates his total lack of understanding of anything that was going on. He wrote, "The Republican government was a government of national betrayal, ordained, as it thought, to fight the Paris proletariat. But the proletariat did not realize this, for it was blinded by patriotic illusions. The patriotic idea had its origin in the great revolution of the 18th century. The minds of the socialists of the commune were under its spell, and Blanqui, for instance, a true revolutionary and an ardent advocate of socialism, could not find a more suitable title for his newspaper than the bourgeois cry of La Patrie en danger, the fatherland in danger." So when I read this, I was, even though I just try to look French, I'm not really French, it offended the fake Frenchman in me. because there's this smug, arrogant condescension towards the French Revolutionary tradition and the failure to recognize how essential it was to the French left is really typical of why everything, I have to say, went wrong in the communist movement. Now, Blanqui, during the fall of 1870, for the only time in his life, had an extended period where he had his own newspaper, uncensored, could write whatever he wanted. And that was La Patrie en Danger. And it lasted only 3 months for lack of readership. Again, if we want to talk about his popularity, 3 months was as far as the newspaper could go. The newspaper opened, though, with a decree, with a declaration. And it says, the government issued from the great movement of September 4th, the day of the Declaration of the Republic, represents Republican thought and national defense. This is enough. Every opposition, every contradiction must disappear in the face of common salvation. When I read this, actually, that sentence, it's part of a very famous, it reminded me very much of a very famous declaration issued at the beginning of World War I by Kaiser Wilhelm, who wrote, when it comes to war, all parties cease and we are all brothers. Now, I don't want to say that Blanqui was at all like Kaiser Wilhelm, but it was the same exact sentiment. You know, in the face of the enemy, we're all brothers. And so Blanqui wanted to cast all the oppositions aside. Cursed be he who, at this supreme moment, can maintain a personal concern, any second thoughts of whatever kind, the underside signed, setting aside any personal opinions, offer the provisional government the most energetic and absolute assistance, with neither reservation nor condition, if not that it maintains the Republic, and it will bury itself along with us beneath the ruins of Paris, rather than sign the dishonor and dismembering of France. So for Blanqui, the only thing that mattered was the defense of the Republic. Any discussion that went on at Blanqui's clubs, if it wandered off defense of the Republic, he didn't want to hear about it. Now, I think Eric before also talked about his kind of high-flown notions of organization and things. He actually said that Paris can assemble 400,000 men in 48 hours. You know, logistics could all be worked out. Pure will solve all the issues. Let me jump ahead, this is only have 5 minutes left. But he believed that war had to be fought to the death, and he said this constantly. You know, there were two camps, that of war to the bitter end and that of genuflection. The Paris of intelligent labor wants defense to the bitter end. It's bursting with indignation at the idea of an ignominious submission. Now, so there's this defense of the Republic to the bitter end. No compromise. If Thiers wants to negotiate, or Trochu wants to negotiate, or surrender, they're the enemy of the Republic. So he's defending the Republic. But he's also, there's a very, very ugly side to Blanqui's defense of the Republic, and that's his anti-German racism, which goes back, actually, way before this, to 1853, when he wrote, oh, how I hate that people, a people of brutes. And so he would write, though, during the war, they are the hordes of the 5th century, spilling over Gaul for the second time in order to submerge modern civilization, just as they devoured its ancestor, Greco-Roman civilization. Or, the Teutons have crossed the Rhine and are again threatening civilization. The races of the south have shuddered at the sound of their steps of these ferocious bands, come from the forests of the north to enslave the south to kings and country squires. Or, he doesn't let up, it's the ferocity of Odin, reinforced by the ferocity of Moloch, that is marching on our cities, the barbarism of the Vandal, and, a hint of what was to come, the Semite. So the differences between France and Germany, as far as Blanqui were concerned, absolutely unbridgeable. The fatherland of philosophy could never unite with ours. The antinomy of the two races is too great. So that's the ugly side of Blanqui and his defense of the Republic. But he was, the more attractive side is the side that harkens back to the French Revolution. Because we haven't discussed at all that his father sat on the convention. Son père, il était membre de la convention, non? Ouais. And we haven't discussed that. So even though his father was not a Jacobin, He does have it in his family's blood. The monarchy is leagued with the invader against the Republic, and the Republic is France. But, however, you know, however optimistic he was, he knew that there was a difference, though, between the people of 1792 and those of 1870. Moral filiation has disappeared. Our fathers of 1792 closed ranks behind the revolutionary government and trampled the internal enemy, monarchy, and bore the point of its sword to the face of its accomplice, the foreign invader. And you rallied to a counter-revolutionary power, prescriber of Republicans, courtier of royalists, and humble servant of the invader. This was the Republican government. And, you know, it's important that it was 1792 and 1793 that he constantly invokes, because these are the years of the Storm of the Tuileries, the Massacre of the Swiss Guards, the September massacres, but also the year of the founding of the Republic. So he, for him, it's 1792 and 1793 are the years. Now, hang on a second, I have to move ahead quickly here. So, of course, we mentioned this before about Paris, how essential Paris was. And he hated or had nothing but contempt for the countryside, which had been degraded by 20 years of repression, panicked by Prussian terror, led astray by counter-revolutionary slanders. They are treason's final resource. As for Paris, which sees clearly, Paris is suspect, held in contempt, denounced the provincial rage and stupidity. This would play out in a really bad way with the Declaration of the Commune, which would be Paris against the countryside, and the end result being 20,000 Parisians killed. Now, Paris was not just an example for France, we discussed this, but for the entire world. For an instant, that of the Great Revolution, Paris touched the highest of summits of moral grandeur. It was able to crush beneath its wall the barbarian hordes, conquer liberty and equality for all peoples, and found the universal republic. And Dumouriez again said, the great biographer, the plebeian dictatorship that Blanqui conceived is the dictatorship of revolutionary Paris over the rest of France. The entire Blanquist strategy flows from the leading role of Paris. And he would write in Un Dernier Mot, his final blast before disappearing, was, Paris has only itself, its own credulity, its own weakness to blame. The world has never seen such a spectacle, an entire population on the road to ruin under the pretext of avoiding it, and in the name of their salvation, drinking to the dregs, the empoisoned concoction, and it will kill them. Now, on the question of Paris, though, what's really interesting about Paris is there must be something in the walls of the city that made it the revolutionary city. Because, as we discussed yesterday, very few of the revolutionaries in Paris were Paris-born. And this happens if you go back to the French Revolution, if you look at all the great leaders of the French Revolution, almost none were Parisians. And this continued in 1830, 1848, and in 1871. When you look up their biographies, they're all people who had moved to Paris from the provinces. And, you know, this is something that deserves, you know, maybe Marissa knows if this has been examined at great length, but it's an interesting question of why is it that it's not the Parisians that are the great revolutionaries or the in Paris. Now, the reason I mentioned Jaurès is that Jaurès, when everybody assumes that Jaurès, had he lived, he would have supported France's efforts in World War I. And maybe he would have, probably would have, maybe he wouldn't. But it's held up as if defending France in the case, in the event of an invasion, is necessarily a bad thing. For Jaurès, just as it was for Blanqui, and this is why it's very odd, you would never think about somebody as revolutionary as Blanqui and somebody as reformist as Jaurès sharing ideas, but for both of them, France represented something special in the world. It was a shining example, the revolution was an example, and the republic was an example. And if you look at everybody now, close your eyes and imagine a map of Europe in 1870. And France is surrounded, except by Switzerland, by monarchies. France is the republic in Europe. So it really is something special. So the, and given its revolutionary history, whereas revolutionary defeatism is an attractive idea in as vile a country as Tsarist Russia, maybe it needs to be viewed a little bit differently in a country like France, where it's still, where they're still defending a revolutionary tradition. So it's no accident that Blanqui was such a patriot, and that Jaurès would be. And in fact, one of the last of the communards, Edouard Vaillant, when war broke out in 1871, said, in the presence of aggression, French socialists will fulfill their duty for the fatherland, for the republic, and for the international. So it's entirely possible, you know, to properly understand Blanqui and to understand much of the French left is to understand just how central the French Revolution is to everything in the French left, at least up until 1936. You know, 1968 really didn't have much to do with the French Revolution. But you know, the presence of the revolutionary figures of France was so essential to the to French left-wing and revolutionary identity that I think that we need to like reconsider dismissing people defending the Republic against monarchical attackers. Now, of course, Blanqui wasn't a Marxist, and so we could say, well, his defense of France is just like the work of a French patriot, a French Republican. But there were people on the other side also, on the German side, who had something to say. The French need a thrashing. If the Prussians win, the centralization of the state power will be useful for the centralization of the German working class. German predominance would also transfer the center of gravity of the workers' movement in Western Europe from France to Germany. And one has only to compare the movements in the two countries from 1866 till now to see that the German working class is superior to the French, both theoretically and organizationally. So this German patriot who wrote a letter to his friend in Manchester was Karl Marx. So we need to seriously consider what the role is of defending your fatherland and what fatherland it is you're defending. But I think this letter from Karl Marx shows that the issue is not nearly as clear as everybody would like it to think. Thank you.
We'll have time for questions and discussion at the end.